We just looked at, what kind of effects can we cause, what does that mean for the code, what parts of the code can I attack, but we haven't talked much yet about actually getting the fault into your system. So I'll talk a little bit about the different kind of ways of injecting faults. So these are some, I don't know who came up with the microwave oven. I guess one of my colleagues felt funny when he was making the slides. That is actually an actual attack device. So it's called an unlooper, and it was used in the pay TV piracy industry, I guess, maybe 15 years ago or so. So what would happen is you would have these smart cards on which the operators would have their keys. You wouldn't be able to get the keys out, but also the subscription would sit in that. So an operator, if you didn't pay or you canceled your subscription with a certain network, it would send out commands to the card to terminate. But they would also send out commands to pirate cards to terminate it. So they had this ability to remotely basically have cards shut down. Now, what shut down actually means is these cards, they didn't, not inspect again, they didn't go up in flames. Basically, they set a bit somewhere, and if this bit was set in the square from, it would just enter an infinite loop and just not respond to commands anymore. So this is called muting the card. What an unlooper actually does is it just does random glitches in the power line to that card. And because it's running in a loop, you get infinite tries to just do different kinds of random attacks. And at some point you might get lucky and it actually breaks out of that loop, just like we were breaking out of for loops earlier. So this was a way to re-enable your cards. So that was actually devices that you could buy and it would do glitching for you. Another way of doing it is using arbitrary waveform generators, which is kind of lab equipment that will generate different shapes and pulses. We actually decided to make one based on an FPGA because it gives us a little bit more control over what the pulse generation looks like. So what we really need is we want to be able to specify all kinds of different things like or control, like timing. At what point do I introduce a fault? How long do I let it last? How often do I repeat it? Those things you want to be able to control from software, ideally. And things like amplitude, so how strong do I drop my voltage, or do I shoot my laser, etc. How much energy do I put into my EMFI probe? And I also want to be able to monitor what the device is doing or how it's responding. Now, one of the things that you need to realize is these things are happening at quite small time scales. Even if you have a processor running at 100 megahertz, that's still only 10 nanoseconds per clock. So if you're running at 1 gigahertz, you're running at 1 nanosecond per clock. And if you want to do clock glitching, you need to overclock from 1 nanosecond to something even shorter. So we're talking about picoseconds at this point. So, you want to have something fast. And then there's, of course, the whole synchronization with the device and external sources for triggers, things like that. So that's what we all are putting together here. And that's why we also made this device. So this is really a basic case of how we've implemented it. The nice yellow box on the right, just consider it an FPGA with some analog hardware around it, so we can control it fully from software. But it can, at that point, act as a real-time device for injecting the faults, or at least timing the faults. And then you can, from your FPGA, you can start sending signals to different kinds of fault injection probes, if you will. So if we're following the arrows to the light, to the left, that's a typical path of how we do power glitching. So we have a analog signal actually coming out of the glitching device. And we have an amplifier, which follows exactly the same signal at the voltage level, but it can provide more current. And then we power our embedded device off of that. So now we have like full control over the power, and with nanosecond precision we can drop the power, spike the power, whatever we want. We can also, for some lower power devices, can actually power directly off the glitcher. That's not so interesting. The cool ones are the laser and the EMFI. So EM pulse injection is what we have here. So it will also control things like the duration of the glitch and the amplitude of the glitch, as well as the timing. And similar for the laser, it controls the length of the glitch and the repetition count. One thing that's not in this picture is an XY stage. So I was fiddling before to find the sweet spot again. Normally we just control the stage and just go to different spots in a matrix and try to find an area of interest, which is mostly trial and error still. But especially for things like laser, you might have a lot of spots. Because with laser, or actually for our lasers, we're going pretty much to the theoretical limit of how small you can get a spot. Because we're using different colors of light, but one of them is in the infrared, which is 1,064 nanometers, which is just over 1 micron. The spot size we can go down to is like 6 micron by 1 micron, something like that. So it doesn't get too much smaller. But it also means that you need to hit a lot of different spots in order to kind of cover an area of the chip. So yeah, that's all something you want to automate with the stage. So the general setup, the one thing I haven't actually included here is the oscilloscope on the top right. But you basically need a glitching device, you need your target, you need some control software, and optionally you can use an oscilloscope, which is nice to kind of see at what point in time you're injecting faults. So from the side channel you can get an idea of, okay, my conditional statement that I'm looking for is around this point in time, and then that helps you identify that. But it's not a necessity. And then there's basically, you split everything up into real-time control, which is loaded up to the FPGA, and anything that's not real-time we just do in software on the PC, like, you know, generating the next set of glitch parameters for the next trial. No need to do that in FPGA, but doing the actual timing of it, yeah, that's what's being done in the FPGA. So conceptually, the way it works, it's a little bit more than just an FPGA. So if you look on the left, you see a CPU. So we actually implemented the soft CPU on the FPGA. That then runs a real-time program. But because the FPGA CPU cannot keep up with the speed that we require, so this thing has, I think, 500 megahertz, like 2 nanosecond resolution. So we have some dedicated hardware for generating that glitch. So the control CPU is real time, it's deterministic, it's, you know, the same speed every time. But in order to get the real precision, you need some external hardware as well. And then there's some control logic over USB and display. It's all not so relevant. But the main thing is that this high-speed interface actually interfaces with the analog hardware that's going to generate the glitch. So that either pulls down the power or generates an EM pulse or you name it. Here you see an example of just some random glitches on the clock. Actually, there's two pictures here. Might not be entirely obvious. You can split that screen in half. On the left-hand side, you see a normal clock where we glitch down with all our glitches are relative on the clock, so we glitch down -5. So you see, apart from on top of this block wave, you see these weird spikes downwards. So those are actually glitches that we introduced. We can also glitch up before. I mean, it's pretty arbitrary in the end. So on the right-hand side, you see these weird spikes up. Now, this is the interesting part happens. I still have a mouse. This is actually an interesting one. And that has to do with the fact that what you're seeing here is, this will probably be ignored by the card, but this starts a clock cycle, then runs very shortly, drops back down, and then starts a new clock cycle. And what can happen here is that in that really short pulse, the CPU will, you know, it usually goes through these stages where it fetches an instruction, it decodes an instruction, executes an instruction, and writes back whatever happened. You corrupt this flow. So it might be that it's starting to fetch an instruction, but it never goes into the write-back stage because it hits the next clock cycle already. So you've effectively skipped an instruction that way. This gets much more complicated when you have like superscalar execution and things like that, but on really simple microcontrollers, these kind of things definitely happen. So just to test you guys also again on color vision. So there's actually three traces that are overlapping here. The beginning part here, they're all overlapping. And here in the middle you see this blue line continues. That's actually the regular pattern that we're supposed to see. What you're seeing here in the light blue on top is our glitch pattern. So this is the supply voltage that we actually drop here shortly and then we put it back up, and we do that 1, 2, 3 times. At the same time, we're also measuring what the glitch trace looks like. And you see that as soon as the glitch hits around here, the power consumption goes low, then it comes back up, it actually shoots up higher than the original trace, comes down a bit again, and goes up, and then it goes down, and by the time we're here, it's kind of at the same as the original again, until the next pulse hits, and we get the same effect in here as well. So, one observation is that the glitch that we introduce on the power is actually shorter than the effect of it. Anybody have an idea what could cause that? Yeah, so there's actually some power effects that take place before the system stabilizes again. Yeah. So capacitors, maybe there's some regulators that have to find the balance. Yeah, kind of answers the second question as well. Why do we overshoot? It's like it's just the system that's trying to reset itself. But this is the hard question. Why do we have two peaks in the overshoot here? What we're looking at is different instructions. Yeah, it's actually a trick question because I don't know the answer. So I'll explain in a second. So the actual glitch that we introduce, so this nice voltage drop here, can have all kinds of cascading effects and deregulating effects. So actual power use is the original power use plus what we did with the glitch plus some kind of response to that. And that's really not always known. And it's also different from device to device. So we were talking about the answer to number one, capacitance. Yeah. Why does it overshoot? Well, we have these voltage regulators. Sorry.
Does the chip have any voltage monitoring?
This one, I'm actually not sure, but this is not, if that's what you're aiming at, this is not an active response to a glitch being detected. So what you'll usually see then is that the pattern completely changes. So chips that defend against this in hardware, they'll have sensors. If you trip one of these sensors, typically either you'll get an interrupt to the CPU or some kind of key wiping gets initiated. In any case, the power trace is going to look completely different than normal operation. So if it has active monitoring and response, you would see that. That's why I think this one doesn't.
So for you, is the main trace a measurement of the current on the VCC line? Glitching on the VCC line and measuring the current.
Yeah, well, we're glitching on the VCC line. I don't know if this is an... I think it might be an EM measurement. Because I see it go positive and negative again, and then that happens every time. So that's an indication of an EM measurement. It's an important point, though, because if you measure and glitch at the same line, the measurement really affects your glitch.
So, I mean, my sense is the biggest radiator is your clock tree, and looking at that, you might have a chip that's operating on both positive and negative edges of the clock, because you've got these two pulses, the big one and the little one, and maybe you just cause both pulses of logic to go at the same time, and that's how you get what you see.
These two pulses, you mean?
Yeah,
that could very well be. I wish I could confirm that, but it's one of the more elaborate answers I've had to this question. So if you basically, these are positive negative edge triggered effects, you may have triggered both of them here is what you're saying. Yeah, it could be. So here there's a lot of question markers. So rises sharply, causing the regulator to drop off. Maybe the regulator kicks in again after the peak is passed, or maybe two edges of the clock hitting at the same time. We don't really know. I actually mentioned this as well. So, but the last point is kind of the takeaway. So, we often don't know what's going on. We can make some educated guesses about where to hit if we know what the power trace looks like. It helps us look at the timing. If we know the die layout, it may help us put the EM probe over the crypto core or over a memory bus or a memory decoder. So those kind of things help in kind of choosing what the next step is. But it's still, in the end, finding that right combination that takes a lot of the time. Well, luckily, a lot of this search can be automated. It's easy to say, let's randomize the timing and let's scan every position on the chip and let's do a variable number of glitches, and before you know it, you have so many, it's such a big parameter space, it'll take forever to try all the combinations. So that's where the human comes in. It's basically to make that small. We have a few experiments with kind of AI-like algorithms that try to optimize the parameters without searching everything. So for instance, if you look at there's a relation between the supply voltage to a card and the clock speed that you can achieve before you get faults. So if you run at a higher voltage, your card can actually run at a higher clock speed as well before it starts faulting. So this is how the physics work out. So finding that boundary, that relation is something you can do relatively well with an intelligent search, because it's just one region in your search space where all the magic happens, and outside you know that you're off. But that's more like one specific example where we could figure out a way to do it. Other places it's still this is what we've seen already. So a few other tools that I want to mention. It's something we call smart triggering. So, in a way, there's multiple points during an algorithm where you can hit an instruction that will give you the effect that you want. But if your algorithm is really jumping around in time, it makes it hard to kind of hit it consistently every time. So this is actually a countermeasure, right? So you randomize the timing of your operations. So that can be either because your clock isn't constant or you're actually introducing random wait states. The people who were this morning, they saw me just make my scope buffer really big and I could see it jump around and that fixed it that way. But this is a real-time system. So if I don't do my glitch at the right time, there's nothing I can fix later. I just need to be there on time or I'm not. So one of the tricks that we use if something is really jumping because of a countermeasure is we synchronize to the process running on the chip by just looking at the side channel signal. So we put an EM probe in or a power probe, and typically before your area of interest for glitching, there'll be some kind of distinctive pattern, an operation which creates in the side channel signal a certain peak or a certain number of peaks. And what we do is we take that, we program that into an FPGA, and the FPGA is now in real time going to match the power signal that comes in with that little pattern that we defined. And as soon as it sees that in the EM or power signal, it will generate a trigger. So instead of synchronizing to the I/O to our target, we're now synchronizing to the operations to the target. And we just try to get as close as possible to the operations of interest. So even if the target is hopping, we're hopping along with it. Again, it's not a 100% guarantee that you find it every time. It's also time consuming to isolate the right parameters, so you're definitely making it harder for an attacker. But it's one of those things where you can come up with another measure to try to circumvent the countermeasure. There's a few other interesting cases that we don't use as much anymore, but in the early days when smart cards were doing this stuff on, they have these active countermeasures that actually wipe the keys. But that's actually something you can also detect in the side channel. So you sacrifice one card, you capture its entire dying process on your oscilloscope. But they have a really nice pattern of what it looks like when a card is initiating a wipe sequence. So once you have that captured in your triggering device, we can also use that to power off the target just as it enters that state where it's wiping its sequence. And then with a bit of luck, it won't be able to commit the wipe before you pull down the power. So again, that's something you need to do in real time as well. You can't do it really time-based. But when you're glitching a lot, in the beginning you're finding all these glitch parameters, you're going to hit all those sensors all the time, so you don't want the target to terminate itself all the time. They need this kind of stuff as well. So conceptually, all the real-time stuff we do in FPGAs, I wish we had a fab, but unfortunately we have to stick with RTL. So conceptually we have some USB control. We load this reference pattern into the device, which then in real time starts calculating what's called a SAD, sum of absolute differences. So you have constantly the power signal coming in, and as soon as the difference between that reference signal and the actual signal becomes really low, in other words, we detect that certain pattern, that's when we send a trigger either to shut down or to inject a fault. So that's really the idea behind this. Other cool toys is things like optical fault injection. So this is basically the laser setup that we use. So on the left you see the turret with the different objectives. On the top you see that yellow box is the laser source. And then there's a camera in front, so you can actually see where you're hitting your target. And at the bottom is the stage that moves everything around. Unfortunately, you never see it like this, because it's actually in a big back enclosed box. It has to do because somebody told us lasers are bad for your eyes. So you have to make a box around it. And also when you think about it, you actually have to go through like laser training before you can use these things. And they give you some examples of what happens to your eye if you shine a class 4 laser on it, which is what we're using. I won't repeat it, but you close the box every time. Those are like 20 watt lasers that you can put on constantly. So they're not pulsed. You can just switch them on, and you burn everything in. That's also cool. So on the left, you see what we do when we're doing what's called a single area fault. So we have one laser beam hitting a particular part of the chip, like a CPU core or a crypto core. Sometimes there's countermeasures, or there are multiple cores involved, and you actually need to hit both of them, but they are located in different areas. So one thing you can do is be very clever with laser beam manipulation and move it to different areas, but we found that was a little bit too slow, because sometimes it really has to be at the same time. So we actually have a second laser source. We don't use this very often, but every now and then we have a second laser source to hit two areas at the same time. But you can imagine how hard it gets to find the right combination of, you know, hitting that first area at the right time, space, intensity, location, and then the second one as well. But some of the like EMVCO, those kind of guys, they require multi-area testing as well. If single area doesn't cut it. I mentioned that already. And then we have the EM fault injection, which is what I was demoing. So we actually find that when we try different ways of glitching something, it's not like it's better or worse than something else, but you just get different effects. And EMFI is really one of those things. So we're seeing on a scale of voltage glitching, where you glitch an entire device, to laser glitching, where you're on, you know, micron scale, you're affecting things. EMFI sits somewhere in between there, at least when it comes to spatial resolution. But the types of glitches you get are actually different. Because, for instance, it will only induce currents in closed circuits. This is how EM pulses work. Whereas with lasers, you can actually open up circuits. So you're actually affecting gates and opening them up. Even when they're, you can open up a PMOS and an NMOS at the same time. So you get all kinds of problems with it burning out. And it gets nasty. So EMFI actually triggers different faults again. And if you look at countermeasures, so if manufacturers implement a countermeasure specifically for laser fault injection, for instance by putting in an optical sensor on a die, they're not going to detect the EMFI. So it can also just be a silly thing of, you know, they've implemented countermeasures against the X, so we just try something else. So that was just a quick run through the kind of tools that we use for these kind of attacks. There's different things. You can heat things up. There's been academic, when optical fault injection was first being published, at least in the academic world, it was really a piece of aluminum foil. They poke a little pinhole in it, and they used a flash of a camera to generate a very intense pulse light, and they glitch things with that. Of course, the timing is completely, you know, we're not talking about nanosecond precision, but they could get all kinds of interesting effects. So this kind of stuff really can go from low-end attacks up to, you know, the multi-area lasers and all that fun stuff. Any other questions about tools?
What's the lowest resolution, or highest resolution laser spot that you're aware of?
I think you can, once the wavelength of the light gets shorter, you can make smaller spots as well.
Right, but you can also do sub-millimeter patterning, so you can just like, you make chips lower than do that in the other direction. I assume you can, I don't see why not.
I'm trying to think if I know any numbers, but I actually don't, so I don't know if I can answer that. I mean, the smallest one I'm aware of is what we just measured ourselves as our spot size. But I know with lithography you can go below the, at least you can have lithography below the wavelength of the light. So, potentially. There is a difference between the spot size in the sense of what the area that you illuminate and what we call the effective spot size. Because typically you have a chip, it's a lot of different layers, kind of like a hamburger, and you can hit it from the top, which means that you have to go through a lot of different metal layers before you hit the gate, or you can shoot from the bottom, which means that you have to go through a lot of substrate before you hit the gate. Substrate is basically silicon. So the effective spot size is the area that you're affecting. So if you hit it from the front side, you're going to get scattering through these metal layers. So that widens the area that you're affecting. If you're going in from the substrate side, you're actually getting diffusion a little bit through that as well. You can, you can thin the substrate and that helps. In the end, from an attacker's point of view, I'm not so interested in the actual spot size, I'm more interested in the effective spot size. I mean, it can really be many times larger than the spot itself. It really helps because it doesn't mean that every spot I hit, I have to shift by 1 micron. I can actually take larger steps when I'm scanning over the chip. Other questions? Let's say we move on. We've talked about tools, we've talked about things that we want to hit. One thing that's really important and the key to all of this is how you choose your parameters for the glitch, so the timing, location, etc. So the key really is to find that one way to tickle your device so it actually does what you want and it doesn't crash or it doesn't burn out. Timing is always important. And then depending on what kind of fault you're injecting, whether it's EM or laser or voltage, there's different patterns that you want to generate. So, for instance, with these cards, if I'm doing clock glitching, I want to make sure that, and this is something that we just experimentally had to find out, we know that if just after the rising edge of the clock, if we wait 12 nanoseconds and then dip it for, I think it's 8 nanoseconds and then come back up, that's when we get corruptions of the opcode. And you could try it at different points in time, nothing will happen. So you need this really specific shape of the clock cycle in order to get a glitch. So these kind of patterns at some point also become important to really hit things in the right way. Timing, it's usually, it's always with respect to a trigger, but the trigger can be generated either based off of the target itself saying I'm going to start crypto, I'm going to raise the trigger, which is in a lab setting usually the case, or you have to use some kind of smart triggering and generate the trigger yourself. But basically what you do is as soon as the trigger comes in, you wait a certain amount of time and then you execute your glitch. We used to use the term wait cycles, which basically refer to the clock cycle, number of clock cycle periods of your target to wait. It's kind of an outdated term because right now we're often not controlling the clock of the target anymore, so we don't really know how many clocks we're waiting, so it's just expressed in nanoseconds. And then after you've waited a certain amount of time, that's when you start your glitch pattern, and then you see what happens after that, either in terms of the side channel or the output that it generates. So you're seeing here, we're taking a side channel trace at the same time as well. You don't see anything specific happen during the glitch. There's maybe here a little bit of a dip in the power consumption that you can see. But maybe I'm just seeing things sometimes. There's nothing there. So when we're talking about clock glitching, there's actually a few other things to look at as well. And that's specifically when during the clock cycle you're causing what. So the example I gave before, I really need to wait for the rising edge and then wait a few nanoseconds, drop it again, and then come back up. So we call that the glitch offset. So basically within the clock cycle, where do we glitch? And then we can glitch up from low clock or down from high clock. And that thing also has to have a certain length. So as you can understand, there's a lot of things to explore.